Tonight on Arena, Cormac Dara and Rady of Lancome on their In the Meadows Festival and a TV adaptation of the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Sympathizer. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena and you can watch proceedings on the live stream, rte.ie/arena. The inaugural In the Meadows Festival will take place on Saturday, June the 8th, headlined and co-curated by Lancome, who will perform their only Dublin show for 2024 on the grounds of the Irish Museum of Modern Art. The one-day event will occur across two stages, Mogwai, Mercury, Rev, John Francis Flynn and Cormac Begley joining Lancome, along with others, on the bill. The last year has been huge for the band. The release of their universally acclaimed Mercury and Ivor Novello Award nominated fourth studio album, False Lancome, which collected Album of the Year honours from the Choice Music Prize, Uncut Magazine, The Guardian, The Quietus and Best Folk Album at the RTE Folk Awards. And Lancome have just announced today the release of a live album called Live in Dublin, which was recorded across three sold out nights at Dublin's Vicar Street. Delighted to be joined in studio this evening by Rady Pete, Dara Lynch and Cormac McDermott, all of Lancome. They left Ian Lynch at home because he got his go a couple of weeks ago when he was in talking about the score for the movie that he had completed. It has been, like, as I list that out, really, it has been quite the year, hasn't it?
Yeah, you were surprising me with that list, to be honest. I was like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, we did all of that.
That's true, actually, yeah. Yeah, no, it's a mad year. It feels like a lot more than longer than a year. But, yeah, I suppose all that stuff did happen, yeah.
Yeah, it did. And it did happen not because of the last year, I guess it's safe to say. Let me go to Dar. It has taken time to get to where you... to those successes that you achieved in the last year.
Even thinking about it was about 12 years ago that we started playing together as a four piece in folk clubs and the Grand Social and stuff like that. So it's been a bit of a journey.
Mm. Do you remember any much of that early days? That gathering of the four of you. Obviously Dara and Ian as the Lynches pre-existed Lancome, the quartet that we have. What do you remember of that, the startings of all of that, Cormac?
Like, just playing lots and lots of tunes in various pubs for a lot of time. Mm. It was great, yeah. It's how we got to know each other musically and creatively, I think.
Yeah, it was a fun time. Me and Cormac knew each other from when I was 12, though, when Cormac was 14. Because I am the youngest in the band.
How many times are you going to tell us that tonight?
No, this is the only time I've ever said that, ever.
It's true.
Exclusive for Arena.
But was there a kind of an immediate connection that you felt? Obviously yourself and Cormac had that connection from teenage years, but was there an immediate connection you felt with the four of you when during those sessions that you were playing in pubs? Is there something that kind of clicks in that you think this is something special?
Yeah, I think, well, it was like we were playing with each other in the sessions, and then it was that Ian and Dara were planning on recording an album, and they asked me and Cormac to just come and play on a few tracks, and then the rest of it is kind of a blur because we just got so excited about it, because like I remember the first couple of practices we just like it totally ran away with itself immediately because we realised we actually had much more in common than just playing in sessions and just our interest in traditional music, and that there was something else for us to kind of create that didn't exist yet,
And you had that already, Dara, yourself and Ian had this, simpatico quality and as a duo, clearly, But when Cormac and Rady came on board, did you feel that? Did you have a sense of what it was?
Yeah.
And, did yourself and Ian go home saying, let's invite them in for a couple of tracks, but let's see how that goes? Or
We had, I think it was like Henry, my son, Daffodil Mulligan and like Ihua on that first album that we just thought we'd get them in to play some extra bits. And it was just, as Rady said, it was just like one rehearsal. And then I can't remember what happened between that first rehearsal and then Cold Old Fire, the album, but it just totally came together, and it wasn't even massive discussions from what I remember. It just happened. It was just everybody knew it was like good to go.
So if the Lynch brothers weren't planning the little coup behind the scenes, were you and Rady Cormac planning? Had you a sense going in? There's more to this than being. We'll play on a couple of tracks with the lads. I'd like more than that.
Not going in, but as it developed, absolutely, yeah. Because it was just, it was loads of fun, and we all just loved singing in harmony, and that was kind of evident from really early days, and yeah.
Yeah, and then there was also like little elements of what has become, I suppose, more the distinctive side of like the sound we make now. Like they were there from the start, the kind of seeds of like we all realized how much we were into the drone and the elements of drone in music, and that's all there in the first album. You know, we just hadn't kind of hadn't come to full fruition yet or whatever. So all those kind of elements, like that was a. We realised that we had like basically all these shared interests really, and that we essentially had an idea for a kind of a music world that we had never heard, but we had kind of, until you make it, you don't even really know what it sounds like, but you have an urge to make it, if you know what I mean, or an urge to like make that a real thing in the world. And I think we have by now.
Yeah, you have.
I think we can say we gave it a good...
Yeah, you gave it a bash.
Yeah, we gave it a bash. Yeah. Definitely put our maximum effort in.
That kind of sound, this sounds like, and tonight we're announcing our, you know, the end
our
of...
our retirement.
Oh, no.
No, we're not.
No, no. No, you, and you will continue to give it a bash in the coming years, I hope. I mentioned, you know, we mentioned the announcement of the live in Dublin album over the, was it three, four gigs in Vicar Street?
Three nights in Vicar Street, in May.
And really mentioning there, Dara, about the drone and the harmonies, that's here in the song that you're releasing today, the Rocky Road
to
Dublin.
Yeah, totally. And yeah, I suppose us being mad into the drone and the vocal harmonies, and then kind of a few years into the project coming across John Spud Murphy, who totally through his experience with kind of harder music, heavier music, knowing how to crank up the low end and the bass on certain tracks. So when we combined the drone thing with his ability to push that bass element, just totally kind of took off.
Yeah, let's have a listen to then from the Live in Dublin album, this version of, which I absolutely adored, with listening to it before the programme tonight, The Rocky Road to Dublin. There you go. What a version of the Rocky Road to Dublin that is, from Lancome, and that from their soon-to-be-released Live in Dublin album. I was asking just as we came to the end of that, really, about who's playing the Busca Chéile at the end.
The Busca Chéile, yeah, it's me on a very old baritone concertina. I think it's about 120 years old.
What does it feel like playing an instrument like that? That obviously has had, you know, multitude
outings. It really looks as old as it is, and it's kind of fallen apart as well. I think I need to replace the bellows, but I just love it. I love the sound of it. I think it's really got a really beautiful, rich kind of tone, and that's because of the reeds. They used to just make better reeds, basically.
Yeah. And the other thing you were saying as we were listening to that was the fact that it's a slip jig, which makes total sense then to come into the instrument at the end, doesn't it?
Yeah. That you're kind of showing the tune version of it almost. Yeah, but that's one of the things that drew us to that song was the unusual kind of rhythm that, you know, kind of sounds like it's not resolving quite in time.
Yeah.
And yeah, the tongue twister element has been fun as well.
You were all delighted as you were listening, Dara, that you were all saying the same words.
Yeah,
just about.
It doesn't always happen.
But I suppose that's one of the challenges in a live album. How aware were you, you know, across those gigs, were trying to get a live album out of this?
I don't remember paying too much attention to that because it's just playing a gig. You just have to. The only thing you can do is just go total tunnel vision and play the songs as best you can.
So
the minute you start thinking about any like outside things like that, you'll kind of start
singing the other words that the others aren't singing.
But that would totally break the magic anyway for any gig. You can never think like you often will catch glimpses of someone like videoing something on their phone when they're, and you cannot think about that. You have to just be enjoying the music you're making. It's the only way to do it
in the moment.
Otherwise, you'll lose it. You'll forget.
And they'll have it on their phone.
Yeah, they'll have it, and it'll be on the internet probably
before the end of the gig.
5 minutes.
You all spoke about Spud in, when you were listening to Spud Murphy, in terms of the production and that.
Yeah.
As it starts out there, Cormac, you know, that low drone, but it just builds across 4 minutes and 6 seconds and still leaves room for the concertina 100%. At the end.
Yeah, he finds space where you don't think there's any more space. Like, it's, yeah, there's like a lovely nuance in what he does. Yeah. Like whenever we record, he sends versions of things, and then he'll say, "Oh no, that's we're just getting started. You know, this is just one version." And then he sends more of it, more versions, and it just gets better.
So it sounds as if it's a quintet, essentially.
Oh, he is. Yeah, he's the fifth member. He's totally essential for us in terms of making making albums. You know, and live sound as well. Like he's really phenomenal at what he
does. Just did we did two gigs over in London on the weekend in the Hackney Empire. And he was down in the sound desk and he was mixing our monitor mixes. He was mixing the live mix and he was playing two synthesizers at the same time.
Yeah. Wow. Okay, so he knows what he's at.
Yeah.
To be able to do that kind of thing live is
oh, totally. Yeah.
And I suppose don't know anyone else who can, to be honest.
Yeah, having that drone aspect there live and that kind of slow build. It's the slow build. I was saying, you know, find a spot on the rocky road to Dublin. I was trying to remember what track it was on, Foul Slank. I still can't remember. That's about 7 or 8 minutes long, and it starts with a very low drone. Yeah. And it, by the end of it, it's this big cacophonous sound. But if you try to come in 2 or 3 minutes in, it just doesn't make any sense. You have to listen to the whole. You have to listen to the whole thing.
Well, I think Spud is really good at as well as textures. So although they're all a drone and they're technically the same note, there's at least 3 or 4 drones actually in there. Mm. And what he's doing is he's kind of revealing the different textures of each drone. That's why they all kind of fit together. You know.
Yeah. Well, as Dara said, what was it? Doing the live mix of the sound of you guys plus playing two synthesizers at the same time. So clearly he's able to build textures.
He's either a madman or a genius or both.
Could be both. Possibly they're the same thing, potentially.
Yeah.
I better ask you a little bit about In the Meadows.
Oh, yeah.
So, first of all, co-curating in this fashion, was it a bit like those early days and those early sessions? Was there a lot of agreement from the outset?
I think so. It was kind of like it was chats between us, the promoters, our manager, and then sussing out. We basically had a big list of people that we were mad into playing with and people that we are fans of, and just finding out who's available and who's able to come to Dublin and who's on for it, basically.
And do you have a guiding, you know, do you have any kind of guiding theme or idea behind it in that respect, Cormac? Or is it just, no, let's get a bundle of people we like, listen to their music and get them to play a gig for
exactly
us?
That, yeah. Exactly that.
Yeah, and it's lovely to be able to give people, like obviously some of the people playing have a massive platform, and then other people maybe have less of a platform, but we really admire their music. So yeah, it's just like great to be able to, you know, we just love showing people things that we like as well. And being like, have you heard this? It's amazing. Have you heard this? So it's kind of like a gig version of that as well, a bit where we're like, you know, there's some people on the bill that we're just really excited for people to see, you know, like the likes of, we've played a few gigs now with Rachel Lavelle. Rachel Lavelle is so good. Mm-hmm. She's so brilliant and her live show is phenomenal. Our very good friend Andy the Dorobum is playing. He is like such an amazing show to go see. Like, can't wait for people to see that. And Anna Palindrome, I've only actually heard them once and they were amazing. And you know what I mean? So it's just, it's lovely to be able to, curate basically, and just.
And when we say In the Meadows, why do we say In the Meadows? Where are we?
Well, I suppose it's outdoor in Royal Hospital Kilmainham. So we're kind of also, a thing that we sat down and talked about was what we have done the last few years is obviously the few nights in Vicar Street once a year. Mm. So we're like, how cool would it be to put it outdoors and see how loud we can possibly get? So that's kind of a challenge for us as well.
So you're going to say to Spud, how loud can you make that drone?
Yeah, basically.
And how many synthesizers can you play at the same time during this during this live outdoor gig? It is a great venue in that respect. You know, you don't have to worry too much either about surrounding houses because you're in the Meadows, you're in the Royal Hospital, and you're away from any potential, you know, reckon some child who's just got to sleep 10 minutes ago. there must be a great freedom in that, Cormac.
Hugely, absolutely. And I think it'll be amazing to see Mogwai as well within that respect, because they get loud, huge sound. Right. Massive, yeah.
All right. And the Live in Dublin album, which has been released, I'm astonished. On what date is it, Darren?
21st of June.
Which is Midsummer's Day. Am I right thinking it is Midsummer's Day? I thought, yeah. Oh, well, what a design that was. Surely there's some kind of mythological event.
There very well could be. And I think when people listen to the live album, there is a running joke throughout the album that the gig itself is a magical ritual to rend a tear in the space-time continuum. So, I don't know, we're kind of fans of magical rituals, I suppose.
Yeah.
Well, let's try to run Taya then in the space-time continuum and see how we get on. On Midsummer.
I think it might have already happened. I think it happened in 2016.
What are we talking about then when we talk about that? If this is not going to send me down a total rabbit hole,
what happened in 2016?
The world just turned upside down. David Bowie died.
David Bowie died.
There you go.
There you go.
All right. We'll have to wait and see if the same thing happens on Midsummer's Night this year. Thanks so much to the three of you.
Thanks for
having
us.
Thank you.
Great to see you. Really looking forward to hearing that live album on the basis of that one track alone. Dara Lynch, Cormac McDermott and Rady Pete of Lancome. Full details on the lineup for the festival in the Meadows, as it is called, on pod.ie. Go to the In the Meadows website, I think is the instruction there, and pod.ie for the album live in Dublin. Thanks again for being with us, lads.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
And so we go to our TV reviews on this Wednesday evening. Sky Atlantic and Now bring us the Sympathiser series based on the Pulitzer Prize winning novel of the same name by writer and recent Arena guest, in fact, Viet Thanh Nguyen, charts the story of the captain, played here by Hoa Chuan De, a North Vietnamese spy in the South Vietnamese army. Confused. He's forced to flee to the US at the end of the Vietnam War. This also stars Academy Award winner Robert Downey Jr., who plays multiple roles in this 7-part black comedy. Next up, Insomnia, latest offering from Paramount Plus, stars Vicky McClure, I suppose best known as D.I. Kate Fleming in Line of Duty. But this new series is adapted from Sarah Pinborough's novel of the same name, that being Insomnia. Thriller follows a mother as she develops insomnia as she approaches her 40th birthday. And finally, The Big Cigar, biographical miniseries on Apple TV. Based on a 2012 Playboy article by Joshua Berman about Huey P. Newton, who was the founder of the Black Panther Party in the 1970s. The series tells the story of his attempts to escape from the FBI to Cuba. Arlene Hunt and Declan Burke have seen all three series. They're with me in studio this evening. We'll start with The Sympathiser, a double agent from Vietnam relocating in the US after the war with Robert Downey Jr. playing a lot of different roles. Let's put Robert Downey Jr. just to the one side for the time being. This is a phenomenally interesting character. The idea of the captain who was this North-South spy in Vietnam, who then comes to America. It's so slippery. You don't know who anybody is for a large part of the thing, Declan.
Yes, and deliberately so, Sean. And the captain, and that's all we're given. We're not actually given his name. He is a kind of a anonymous character deliberately. So when we first meet him, he's sitting in a cell. He's actually writing his memoir/confession about his time in America. And then we get these extended flashbacks to a period just before the fall of Saigon in 1975. And the captain, as you say, he is initially he's working for the South Vietnamese Army Secret Police under the general. But we quickly realise that, in fact, he's a mole on behalf of the Viet Cong. But that's not the only dual role that he plays in this series, because he's also what they describe as biracial. He had a Vietnamese mother and a French father, and he's also bicultural because he grew up Vietnamese, but he spent quite a period of his life in college in the United States and then came back to Vietnam. Mm. So he's the classic kind of character who's the outsider, but also very much an insider.
Oh, let's listen to a clip which features Hoa Chuan De then as the captain. There's a poor student reporter here led by Jacob Breton who is interviewing him. And imagine getting these set of slippery answers.
Did you feel the support and solidarity of American student activists?
Not so much.
We were all marching. You know, we were on your side.
Really? And which side was that?
The side of the Vietnamese people.
Oh. Which people? The people in the north or the people in the south?
Well, all of them, I guess.
Guess we all look the same after all, right? I mean, I could be Viet Cong, for all you know. Undercover. How would you know? I'm not, of course. I love America.
So did you kill anyone?
There's a test for your interviewing skills. That is Jacob Brennan as the poor student reporter interviewing the captain, played by Hua Xuande from the Apple TV series, isn't it? Yeah, the sympathizer, Arlene Hunt. I mean, that as a clip to make you want to watch it,
it's
just phenomenal.
Great. He's slippery is just such a brilliant expression that you use for him, because he really is. Mm. He says, you know, he's kind of cursed because he's half French, half Vietnamese, but actually it completely gives him the skill to blend in all worlds. You know, he can move through. People don't notice him as much. Mm. You know, they don't pay attention to him at all in close detail. Well, that's not true. Sandra Oh's character, she does, because she can detect a false note in him from an early stage. That's not giving any plot away. Yeah, she just detects it. But nobody else does. And he's just got this marvellous way of manipulating the people around him. You know, he's subservient to the people he needs to be subservient to. Mm. He's snarky with the people. He doesn't need to be snarky. Like, and he has this interesting, like almost like a chameleon-like way of moving through society, you know.
And that complexity of that character and that wonderful facility that Hua Xuande has as the actor, to give us that sense of danger and then laugh it off, and you think, oh, who am I actually in the room with here? Must have been the feeling in poor Jacob Brennan, well, the student reporter's mind. I guess that reflects the complexity of the situation. I mean, there's a very telling line in that clip, Declan, where he says, I guess we all look the same, don't we? Which kind of gives you a sense of where this is going in the American attitude to, as they call it, the Vietnamese or the Vietnam War, but as people from Vietnam might call it, the American War.
Yes, indeed. And in the second episode, in the first episode, we get Robert Downey Jr., as you referred to him, as a CIA agent, and he's a classic kind of hard-boiled double-dealing and so forth. In the second episode, we also get Robert Downey Jr. playing a completely different character. He's an Oriental, a professor of Oriental studies, I should say, and he describes himself as an egg, who is white on the outside and yellow on the inside. And this is all performance art for this character. He really has no more interest in the Vietnamese people except as kind of tools to promote his own career and so forth. And in fact, Robert Downey Jr. plays four different characters throughout the course of the series. But this character, Professor Hammer in particular, is a brilliant example of how America perceives not only Vietnam, but also the Far East, quote unquote. And that line where you're quoting as well, this idea, we all look the same, you know, after all. This is the, you know, the,
so there's a real point being made by having Robert Downey Jr. play all of these characters in that respect, all of these Western characters.
Very much. And all of them coming from very different perspectives, but all really summing up the kind of Western attitude towards.
So let's get a sense of that. Once again, we have Hua Xuande as the captain here. He's having a dinner with Claude. That's one of the characters, Professor Hammer, and Congressman Ned Goodwin. All of them played by Robert Downey Jr. And then along comes a filmmaker called Nico Damianos, played by, I think you've probably worked it out by now, Robert Downey Jr.
Turns out the professor inspired our friend's next project.
Actually, he read an article of mine in the New Republic. It was about the first forays of the Green Berets into the Highlands, and he's latched onto it.
Yeah.
They say imitation is the highest form of flattery. I wouldn't mind a bit of compensation.
And he comes on strong, making all kinds of demands about hardware that I can provide you, because my relationship with the National Guard, trucks, tanks.
Yeah, who does he mean by he?
Thank God I'm here. How's everyone doing?
Right this way.
Fashionably late, huh?
Thanks.
All's good, I trust. Our sacred allied force. So you're my Vietnamese guy.
Excuse me? Who are you?
Really? First words out of his mouth?
You don't know who he is.
Nikos Demianos.
You never heard of the combination? And the combination too.
Oh, sure.
You don't know, he knows the movies, just not your face, right?
Yeah.
Okay, but for starters, have you seen the movies?
The first? About a quarter?
So you got bored, you walked out, what, you thought it was garbage? What are you, a critic?
Air raid warning. Evacuated the cinema. I liked what I saw, though, so don't tell me the ending.
There you go. That's several Robert Downey Jr.'s out. Well, one Robert Downey Jr., several characters from The Sympathizer and the captain played by Washwande. I guess it's difficult with the audio there because you don't get the visuals of it being Robert Downey Jr.
And also he doesn't sound as different
when you see him.
But he is quite visually different. I mean, my favorite of his is the CIA character, though. He plays, he's everything that you dislike. Mm. He's brash. He's kind of dangerous. It's in the opening, and he's the guy, and he's a double-crossing fiend himself, and he's instantly dislikable. And Robert Downey Jr. is really good at playing dislikable. He's really yes. good at it. Like, I know he can be the hero in certain things, but he's really, really good when he's allowed off the chain and he can be at his worst self. And he's at his worst self in a lot of this. Yeah.
So it isn't just a gimmick having him play all those roles.
I don't think it's a gimmick. No, I really don't think so, because he brings to the characters a certain oiliness that they need to who they are and how they operate, how they are. Like, his professor is just the most miserably cretinous, horrible.
Yeah.
He's a creep, a creep. And he doesn't, he humiliates people all around him because he throws a party at one point. And he has everyone dressed up like geishas and things like that because he has no concept of of any historical reference, only for what he wants for himself.
All right. It sounds, we might just briefly, you mentioned, Arlene mentioned Sandra Oh. Were there any other standout performances for you, Downey Jr. and Hua Xuande? Certainly on the basis of those two clips, are both acquit themselves very well, Declan?
Tony Lee plays a character called Man, who is effectively the captain's handler, used to be his boyhood friend and has now become the kind of really steely Viet Cong leader and so forth, who completely, so the captain is completely under suspicion because he's been to the States, he's corrupted and so forth. He puts in a great performance.
All right. Sounds like you're both recommending this one. Stars from you, Declan?
Four stars from me. I think it's a very strong
story. Arlene?
Me too. Four stars.
It's a good solid four. And Sky Atlantic, by the way, it is on. I think I may have ascribed it to a different channel previously. Sky Atlantic is where you will find it. Let's move on then to Insomnia, thriller series on Paramount. Vicky McClure as Emma Averill, who appears to have it all. She's a middle class lawyer, wife to a handsome husband, and has two children. Why do I know that she doesn't have it all, or that there's something rotten in the state of Vicky McClure's character here?
What could it possibly be? What could make you think such a thing? Things go very wrong for Emma very quickly. She is approaching 40, and her mom had been institutionalized at 40 years of age. So it's always in the back of her mind that, what happened to her mother, which was a complete mental breakdown. She fears that this might happen herself. And rolling up towards her 40th birthday, she starts to lose sleep. She just stops sleeping.
And hence the title, Insomnia.
Insomnia. And she doesn't sleep. And she finds herself acting out in a strange way because she loses more and more sleep. She gets into that dizzy, foggy state that people do when they stop sleeping. And she has weird bedtime behaviours, and she's sleepwalking. She frequently ends up in the pond on their property. And everything, she just doubts herself the whole time. She completely has it in her mind that this is what's going to happen now. This is what's happening to me, and this is the way it's going to go.
Which sounds as if we had a slippery character in the previous one, sounds as if we're a very slippery world in Insomnia. Let's have a listen to a clip then. Vicky McClure here as Emma. She's visited by her close friend Michelle Simpson, played by Jade Harrison, and they're talking about the whole topic of insomnia.
You look pale.
What's that?
I didn't book an appointment, Dr. Sanford.
Come on.
I'm fine. I'm just not sleeping great. So here's one for you. Can insomnia run in families?
Sometimes. Depends what's causing it.
Stress, probably.
Well, call me if it carries on. There's no point being a martyr about it. There's medication to be had.
Hey, Michelle.
Hello.
Hi.
Got changed quickly? Well done. There's wine open if you want some, Chloe.
I'm good.
Well, Em. No way. How can you remind me?
Because I'm so busy at work.
But it's your 40th.
That's Emma, played by Vicky McClure, and her close friend, played Michelle Simpson, played by Jade Harrison. We're in preview mode on this one, Arlene, so we have to be incredibly careful around spoiler alerts. This is a thriller, and I already know, just from listening to that clip, all sorts of, there are going to be red herrings, but there are also going to be
huge
reveals.
She's an unreliable narrator from the get-go.
She's halfway, she doesn't get any sleep.
I mean, you can only do that for so long before you have brain fog and you don't know what you're doing. And you're physically doing things on autopilot that you don't even realise you're doing. I really related to this because I'm an insomniac myself. So it's like, I could see lots of things in this. They were like, oh God, of course. So you're unreliable in, you know, and so when you're the unreliable narrator in any series, how are you trusted? How can you be trusted? How can you trust?
And because we have an unreliable narrator, do we also have an unreliable director and storyteller here who are making the narrator even more unreliable? How slippery is the world without, again, I know you have to be careful about spoilers on this.
Yes, I don't think I've ever seen a TV show come hedged about with as many embargoes, and justifiably so. You used the word red herring, Sean. Yes, there is a certain amount of that. I think this is as a thriller, it works very effectively. I think there's something much more interesting going on under the surface on this, and this comes back to your question. This is as much a series about memory, about what we can trust, who we can trust. Can we trust ourselves? There's a telling line, I'm remembering all things all wrong, which is Emma's kind of belated realization that the whole foundations upon which her life have been built, her perception of herself may not be at all true. And you know, it's a kind of a jaw-dropping moment that adds, I think, considerably to what otherwise would have been a fairly standard kind
and
of
and Vicky McClure, I'm guessing, adds huge amounts to this, as I'm sure do Tom Cullen, rather, plays the husband. And I don't know how much I trust the best friend either. I'm guessing that you're saying will you continue watching?
Yes.
Yes.
I will, for sure.
I'll certainly, it comes at you wave after wave of revelation. You can't look away, Sean.
All right. Okay. And that is available to stream on Paramount Plus from tomorrow. Finally, then, The Big Cigar, biographical miniseries on Apple TV. This is the one that's on Apple TV, based on a Playboy article, which sounds, oh yeah, what's that about? But this is very serious material. In fact, Huey P. Newton, who was the founder of the Black Panther Party in the 70s, you know, that's why people bought Playboy for the articles. This was a very interesting.
So I'm told. Yeah.
This was a very interesting article about a very interesting topic and period in American history, Arlene.
Yeah, you're talking about race, and it's the most poisonous conversation to have. I mean, it's poisonous now and it's poisonous then, but this was a time of like great civil unrest, and this is when, you know, black men and black women were willing to go above and beyond and out to bat for their own rights and for the civil rights that they were demanded. And this was also about, you know, self-defense against the political forces, the NRA, the FBI, you know, it seemed like the whole of society were against, you know, African-American people. So they had no choice but to band together. And Huey P. Newton was a huge, huge part of this.
And I suppose the big Huey P. Newton story is everybody has the right to carry arms, unless, of course, you're black, which is the constant message.
And the NRA went against this, of all the people.
Yeah, of course, who were always about, oh, we need to be able to carry arms. But he knows the letter to the law, and that's how he wins through here.
Deliberately getting himself caught in kind of stop and search scenarios so that he could quote the law verbatim to the police and absolutely befuddle them. It didn't keep him out of trouble, of course. But yes, he was something new as far as white America was concerned. And as a result, well, not the only result, but this is why he, as the leader of the Black Panthers, was considered public enemy number one.
Who's playing him here?
Andre Holland.
Yeah, and I guess a lot of it falls on his shoulders. He's carrying it for the most part, and he narrates a lot of it.
He does, and he's. I thought he was the highlight of this because he's a really terrific actor, and he carries himself with a certain amount of panache and aggression and everything that you'd need to have in a leader. You know, someone who men will and women will follow, and he holds himself in a certain regard. The last thing he wants to do, like, so they're raising money all the time. They're constantly raising funds for their communities, for schools, for their feeding of students. They're always trying to raise money. And eventually it comes to a point where his own advisors are saying to him, listen, Hollywood, there's a lot of radicals in Hollywood at the time, and they wanted to come in and put some money in. But you're talking about white producers, white film producers, and white directors. And for the longest of time, he wanted nothing to do with them because they had no concept of what he was doing.
Yeah, there's a wonderful point made in the first episode, which I only saw part of, where the Huey P. Newton character is saying, we have more in common with the white people of Appalachia, the poor working class. He said, they're the people we should be talking to, not these Hollywood producers. It's a phenomenal story. And I noticed that Don Cheadle, who was with Brendan Gleeson, of course, on The Guard, and a fine actor himself, Don Cheadle, he's one of the directors here. This sounds like an interesting series, Declan.
I think it's a terrific idea because the Hollywood aspect, the big cigar refers to Cuba. Hollywood tries to get Huey P. Newton out of America, you know, hatches this concept to make a film in Cuba and so forth. I think it's very slick. I don't think it's facile in places in the way it depicts the reality of Huey P. Newton's life. But as a fun kind of entertaining tale, I think it's solid.
Stars?
Yeah. 3 stars for me.
And from you, Arlene?
Two.
Two from you, so you're not quite as happy.
I just found it really glib.
Yeah.
And, you know, this man deserves to have his story told because he's a really important figure and he deserves a weightier look at his life and what he stood for.
Okay, that's a point well made from Arlene there. Arlene Hunt and Declan Burke are two reviewers this evening at the Sympathisers, Sky Atlantic and Now from Monday the 27th of next week. First 2 episodes of Insomnia available to stream on Paramount Plus from tomorrow, and The Big Cigar is out now on Apple TV. The stage adaptation of Susan Hill's novella The Woman in Black is coming back to the Gaiety Theatre. Robin Harford, who commissioned the original stage adaptation of the play by Stephen Malotrat for the Stephen Joseph Theatre in Scarborough in 1987, with its first production in the theatre's pub. Now it is the second longest running production in the West End, with over 7 million people having seen the play. And Robert Harford joins us now. He has directed the production for the last 34 years, from its inception as a stage play right up until recent times, with this tour coming to Dublin. Lovely to have you with us on the programme this evening, Robert. Had you any idea, and I'm sure you've been asked this a million times, back in 1987, that you'd be talking to us in 2024 about it? Robin, I think I misnamed you there, Robin, sorry. Had you any idea that it would actually last this long and be the phenomenal success that it is?
Absolutely no idea. I needed it to run for 3.5 weeks. That's what to play to 70 people a night. That was the maximum we could fit into the little studio theatre in the bar.
Yeah, and you were stand-in artistic director, I think, at the time.
That's right. Alan Akeborn, now Sir Alan Akeborn, was at the National Theatre on a 2-year sabbatical to have his own company there. And he asked me to run the theatre in his stead. I was his associate director at the time, and he gave me the top job for two years. It was like, it was just a question of being in the right place at the right time.
And the play, the book, the novel itself, were you aware of the Susan Hill novella? Had you read it?
No, I hadn't. I just thought, I tell you what, it was Yorkshire meanness, because I had a little money left over in my production budget, and the outgoing general manager had said to me, whatever you do, spend all your grant, because if you don't get in next year. So I found I had a little bit left over, so I thought, we'll have to do an extra production. So this wasn't a scheduled production. And I thought I had a show for children running at Christmas time, morning and afternoon in the main house. And I thought we'd do something for our long-suffering adult audiences in the bar in the evening. And I thought a ghost story would be a good idea. So I said to Stephen, I'd either adapt an existing one or write an original one.
And it was he that suggested, Susan, it was Stephen Malatrat that suggested the Susan Hill novella to you. Give us the essence of the story, because it's so creepy and it's such a gothic tale with shrieks in the audience, I'm sure, at very, well, very assigned points throughout the night.
It's a story of a young lawyer in the 1920s who is sent up to wind up the estate of an old woman who's just died, who lives as a recluse on a rather strangely situated house. And when he goes there, he has a terrible experience, which effectively blights his whole life. And 30 years on, he has realized that he must tell this story to try and, relieve himself of it. And he hires a young actor who helps him to tell the story, who turns the story into a play. And so the two of them act it out. Mm, yeah. And that's where the fun begins.
Yeah, and of course... is the woman in black there? Is the woman in black not there? You will have to go and find out, I guess.
Absolutely, you will.
Now, given that you've been involved in the production and in directing it for so long, how hard is it to keep that fresh? I mean, you have had some serious talent playing these parts along the way. Martin Freeman, Joseph Fiennes, and the list goes on and on.
Yes, yes, yes. I mean, it's do you know the recasting of the show has been its savior, and certainly as far as, because otherwise what tends to happen is that you if you just say, all right, we'll do it exactly as we did it last time, and so you get a slightly sort of blurred carbon copy that gets fainter and fainter. So because there are only two actors in the play, it's great, because you can sort of say to them, look, you know, you're two actors on the stage. You don't have to follow the moves of previous actors. You go where you like. And I want to hear your version of the play. I want your reaction, your emotional response, your intellectual response, your imaginative response to how these parts should be played. And that's what happens. And that's great, because that gives me a fillip every sort of 9 months when I'm putting a new cast in.
Yeah, because I suppose often in a big West End musical, you know, because it's such a big machine, there's no place for you to be saying, well, can I, any chance I can move over there? No, because there's a two-ton piece of scenery coming across. No, you can't move there. Whereas with two people on the stage, you can allow that reinterpretation, and you can allow that. I suppose you probably find new things then in the play each time you do it.
Yes. Well, you know, they find the new things. Mm. And the great thing is that, as with anything, if you found something yourself, you're more committed to it than if someone said, why didn't you do it just like this, you know? So it's their input. I mean, for example, you mentioned Joe Fiennes and Martin Freeman. It was Joe Fiennes' very first job. He was still at drama school when I cast him. And Martin Freeman was about 14 when I cast him. Well, he looked about 14. He was probably about 22. But it was right at the beginning of his career too. But so different. Joe Fiennes, who played Shakespeare in Shakespeare in Love, it was very much the sort of leading juvenile. Whereas Martin, it was a riot when he did it, because he's just such a funny man.
Yeah, so I suppose that's the actor character who plays
That's right.
Yeah, that actor character, I suppose, gets to do a fair bit of showing off in the process of playing these various characters.
Yes, I mean both parts actually, both the older, they both play Arthur Kipps, which is slightly confusing. Arthur Kipps is the solicitor to whom this all happened. And we meet him first in the theatre as an old man, The young actor is helping him tell the story, and he says, okay, I will play you as a young man and you will play all the people you met. So it's a gift for an actor, and it really celebrates the art of acting and the liveness of theatre. People don't expect to be scared in a theatre, but I think they could be in for a shock.
Yeah, but that is the thing about The Woman in Black, isn't it? That you, while you have that room for the interpretation of the actors in the various, in the two roles in front of us on the stage, there are certain things that, you know, the famous line about what's my motivation for saying that line in a comedy? Your motivation for saying that line in the comedy is so that the guy after you can tell the joke. So just say the line, please. There must be a bit of that in this show as well, where you need to have certain things happening in a certain way at a certain pace for the bang of the fright to come at the right moment.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a great... you know, that's why I say that it celebrates the skill of the actor, because there is so much technique involved in delivering a play, especially as there are only two of you. You are working your socks off for 2 hours, you know, it really people say, I couldn't believe there are only two people on that stage. You know, so it's a great lesson in what and how little you need to tell a story. I mean, I only had £1,000 to build the set and have the costumes.
Wow.
And I had enough money to pay for four actors, a maximum of four actors, to rehearse for 3 weeks and play for 3 weeks. And you know, and I said to Stephen, you cannot go over that budget. You cannot go over that budget. So he had to provide, something to fit that brief.
Necessity is the mother of invention. I'm guessing it has made more than £1,000 for both of you in the intervening years. We should mention briefly, who are the two actors that are coming to Dublin? Do you have that to hand?
I do. Malcolm James is playing the older man and Mark Hawkins is playing the younger man. And they're both terrific. They've both done it before, both in the West End at the Fortune Theatre, and Malcolm has also done it on a previous tour. Right. So there's a select brotherhood of actors who've played the part before, and they bear the scars.
Well, listen, lovely to have spoken with you this evening, Robin. Thanks for sharing your time with us and your thoughts. That's Robin Herford, director of The Woman in Black, which will be coming to the Gaiety Theatre from the 20th of May through until the 1st of June. GaietyTheatre.ie for full details on that. And that is our lot for this Wednesday evening. Niall Fitzmaurice, Leah Murphy and Barbara Sandro were the researchers. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. I will talk to you tomorrow night once again, 7 o'clock. Here on RT Radio 1, John Creedon will be with you after the news.